Behind the Lines.
Inside the Newsroom from Guardian Australia.
Hi, I'm Gabrielle Jackson. Welcome to Behind the Lines. And have I got an episode in store for you today? I went to a talk at the US Studies Center at Sydney University last week with Thomas Frank, the American political analyst, author, and Guardian columnist. And it was fascinating. The thing about Thomas Frank that I love is that he has been doing what a lot of journalists haven't been doing. He's been, since the recession and even before that, going out into middle America, going to Rust Belt towns, talking to workers. Anyone who said that the media didn't know what was happening in America before the election of Donald Trump was not listening to Thomas Frank, or was not reading his column in The Guardian, as a matter of fact, or his many books. In the talk that we're going to listen to now, Tom describes how the Democrats lost control of America and why he thinks it suits the Republicans to erode people's faith in the government. His book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, I'm reading at the moment, I highly recommend as well. And that documents some of what he talks about in this talk here. So here he is, looking back at what the last couple of years have felt like for Americans who, you know, work for a living.
The last couple of years in the United States have been a time of brisk prosperity. According to official measurements, you know, unemployment rate is way down. The stock market is way up. Productivity improves all the time in the USA. For Americans who work for a living, however, nothing ever seems to get better. Wages don't grow. The median income and median household income in the United States is still well below where it was in 2007. If you look at the economists have a measurement they call the workers' share of the gross national product, and it hit a record low in 2011, record low since World War II, down, 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 boom, rock bottom, and it's still there. And in the fall of 2014, just I guess a little more than 2 years ago, with the stock market hitting an all-time high, a poll showed that nearly three quarters the American public thought the economy was still in recession, because for them, of course, it was. Now, there's a time when the American public could be counted on to know whether things were up or things were down, right? Whether the country was prospering or whether the country was falling backwards, because when America prospered, once upon a time, the American people prospered as well. But these days, things are different. To do it by the numbers, if you go from the middle of the 1930s up to 1980, the lower 90% of the population, a group that we might call the American people, took home 70% of the growth in the country's income. If you look at that same statistic beginning in from 1997, you know, the beginning of the great dot-com boom, from 1997 to the present, if you look at that same number, and you'll find that this same group, the American people, pocketed none of the country's income growth at all. Their share of these great good times was zero, okay? The upper 10% of the population, the country's financiers, its managers, and its professionals, consumed the entire thing. To be a young person in America is to understand instinctively the downward slope that most of us are on these days. College costs are out of control. The University of Chicago, where I got my PhD, today costs nearly $65,000 American dollars a year to attend. Okay, 4 years of that is north of $250,000. You want to go to a school like that, you've got to take out a lot of loans. And I'm forever meeting young people in my country who carry $100,000 in student debt. Young people, people just starting out in life. This is common in the United States. Okay? They are starting life with the equivalent of a mortgage, but they've got no house to show for it. Now, at the other end of the social ladder in my country, it is all upside all the time. Back in 1980, American CEOs made about 40 times as much as the average blue-collar line worker. Today, it's 373 times as much. One particularly lucky American family, in fact, has as much wealth as does 40% of the population. The main accomplishment of the high-achieving individuals who make up this family was to inherit shares in Walmart. Y'all know what Walmart is? This is the, if you want to study America, you've got to know what Walmart is. I'm quite serious about that. And that's where the country is, 8 years post-Obama. Growth that doesn't grow, prosperity that doesn't prosper. The country, we now understand, is simply no longer arranged in a way so as to make its citizens economically secure. That's the great middle-class nation. The middle class is disintegrating. Now, you would expect the developments that I've just described, and that, like I said, they've been going on for quite a while. You would expect these developments to lead to a revival of the left, some kind of explosion like in the 1890s or the 1930s. And yet, here is the fascinating thing. This is what keeps me going and what I write about all the time. The politics of this age of inequality have been dominated by right-wing revolts that only accelerate the disintegration of the middle class. It's the Trump, you know, Trump presidency right now. I still have to pinch myself when I say that. I just can't believe it happened, but that's where we are. Donald Trump sits on the presidential throne, but in truth, depending on how you count it, this is the fifth successful conservative uprising to happen in my lifetime. Okay? There's Nixon, there's Reagan in the 1970s, there's Gingrich, there's the Tea Party movement, George W. Bush, and now Trump. And it is just, it blows my mind the way this thing just keeps chugging along. Think about for a second what things looked like back in 2008 and 2009 after the financial crisis and the Great Recession seemed to discredit the conservative philosophy for good, okay? I mean, just think about what things were like in those days. The, you know, calamitous George W. Bush presidency had come to this sort of crushing end after a series of scandals that, you know, culminated the Iraq War, the Abramoff scandal, all of this stuff culminated in the financial crisis. You had these fraudulent mortgage-backed securities as a direct result of all the bank deregulation that we've been doing for 20 years. And the pundits where I live today, I live in Washington, the land of consensus, and all the consensus pundits said they knew what was happening. They'd seen this movie before, and they knew how it was supposed to go. The tectonic plates were shifting, they said. Conservatism's decades-long reign was finally at an end. This is in 2009. An era of liberal activism was at hand. The pendulum had swung one way, and now it was time for the pendulum to go the other way. Republicans had to get with the flow of history or else disappear, they said in 2009. What the right-thinking world, the place that I inhabit, what this world expected from the leaders of the Republican Party back in 2009 was penitence. What we got was the exact opposite, and I mean delivered on the point of a bayonet. Instead of elevating their remaining centrists to power, the Republicans purged those guys. Instead of moving to the center, they shifted farther and farther to the libertarian right. Okay, double down on deregulation. And in 2010, this radicalized Republican Party scored the greatest victory in congressional elections in many decades. They took 600 seats from the Democrats at state-level elections. They purged countless Republican moderates from the Senate and from the House of Representatives. In 2014, they conquered the Senate, and today the tragedy is complete. These guys control the presidency. They control Congress. Trump just got to choose a justice for the Supreme Court. And they control the most state legislatures that they have controlled since the 1920s. It is truly a wipeout, not only for the Democrats, but also for the pundits who have so persistently predicted a Democratic revival, taken it for granted, said it was the forces of nature would deliver it. Now, this is all going on Remember, while Wall Street loots the world and the middle class falls apart. Many years ago, I wrote this book about right-wing populism in my home state of Kansas, which is a very populist place. It has a tradition of radicalism. But these days, I wrote in this book, the gravity of discontent pulls to the right and to the right and further to the right. And when I wrote that, I meant to describe what I thought of as an aberration, a historical aberration, a geographical aberration. Today, though, the gravity of discontent works that way all over America. That's just what discontent is. You know, it goes automatically. If you're pissed off, you're going to be voting for Trump. How come? Why does it work that way? Now, one reason is because, as I pointed out in What's the Matter with Kansas, our party of the right in America is very comfortable talking about class grievances, never in a direct way in the old days. It's more direct now, but back when I was writing that, you'd hear them grouse constantly about, you know, the Hollywood millionaires and the arrogant people that make our TV shows and the, you know, hard-bitten real Americans who inhabit the heartland. The right wing in America deliberately mimics left wing protest movements. This is what the Tea Party movement was. They were deliberately trying to look and act like a protest movement from the 1930s or from the 1960s. And here comes Donald Trump, America's blue collar billionaire, is what they called him at the Republican convention. By the way, nobody laughed then. They were like, yeah, that makes perfect sense to them. He gave a speech at the convention and he pledged himself to the working class voters who had been left behind by the current recovery. This is what he said. I have visited the laid off factory workers and the communities crushed by our horrible and unfair trade deals. It's an unmistakable echo of Franklin Roosevelt. Here's what he says. These are the forgotten men and women of our country, people who work hard but no longer have a voice. He also, in continuing in the same speech, he tried to reverse the traditional liberal criticism of the right as being pawns of the billionaire class. This is what he said. Big business, elite media, and major donors are lining up behind the campaign of my opponent because they know she will keep our rigged system in place. They're throwing money at her because they have total control over everything she does. She is their puppet, and they pull the strings. Now, Donald Trump is a hypocrite and a vulgarian and a bigot, but this man connected emotionally. He was, you know, when he said that the system was rigged, he's right. It is. When he pointed out that huge parts of the country have been deindustrialized and that this is a disaster for the people who live in those places, that is true. That is correct. What's crazy, what drives me absolutely bats, is that those are the things that my people used to say. Those are the things that people on the left used to say, and now it's Trump. Okay, so let's talk about that left. Let's talk about the Democrats who are in our system where the two-party system is essentially guaranteed by law. We can talk about, there's a lot of particulars, but it basically is. The Democrats are the more left of our two parties. And for these guys, protecting the middle class society was once a kind of holy mission. This was why the party existed. This is why you had a Democratic Party. And once upon a time, you know, these guys, the Democratic leaders, would have taken one look at the situation that I just described in America, and they would have known exactly what to do. Someone like Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Franklin Roosevelt, they would have known exactly what to do about this situation we're in. But our modern Democratic leaders just seem to falter. They acknowledge that what they like to call inequality, that's always their favorite word for the situation, inequality, they say, oh, it's terrible, it's rampant. But they can't find the conviction or the imagination to do what is necessary to put this thing into reverse. Instead, they offer the same high-minded policy platitudes that they have been dishing up since the 1980s. They tell us there's nothing anybody can do about technology, right? There's nothing anybody can do about globalization. That's the hand of God reaching down into human affairs. Nothing you can do about that. It's the inevitable globalization. And so they promise us charter schools and job training, and they'll shovel out the student loans. But other than that, they have got nothing. Take the issue of the Wall Street bailouts, which I think to this day is still the most important issue of our dumb century, not only in America, but maybe in the entire world. The fact that our government bailed out the Wall Street banks rather than putting them out of business, which they so richly deserved. This was the inflection point in America, the place where the country could have changed course, could easily have changed course. But our leaders chose not to. Let me try to describe what things were like in those days. Barack Obama, this heroic figure. I thought he was my generation's Franklin Roosevelt. And he is elected to the presidency in this incredible wave of hope and enthusiasm. He is beloved around the world. The country is at his back. And then he proceeded to continue the policies of President Bush as regards Wall Street, to continue those policies essentially unchanged. No big banks got put into receivership. No bailouts were unwound. No elite bankers were prosecuted. None of them, they didn't even get fired. Completely within his power to do it, chose not to. Obama and his Democrats, what I'm saying is that they refused to change course when every sign was telling them to turn, when it would have been good for the country to make that turn, when it was fully within their power to turn, when it would have been overwhelmingly popular to turn, and when the country fully, and this is important, when the country expected them to turn. And when I say the country expected them to turn, I mean the Wall Street bankers themselves. There's a famous incident back in 2009. Obama had just come into the presidency. He called a meeting with the Wall Street bankers. They came down from New York. And they go into the meeting, they're ashen-faced. No, there's no smiles to be seen. They know they're going to get taken to the woodshed. And they come out of that meeting and, hey, man, things are great. They are so happy. When you look at why Barack Obama did this, why did he play this greatest of all issues the way that he did? It's not because the white working class rose up to defend its friends on Wall Street. He didn't do it this way because, making the Republicans defend investment banking was a bad political strategy. Nor did he do it this way because the presidency lacks sufficient power. The presidency is an enormously powerful office, and it was fully within his power to do all the things I just described. Firing these people, prosecuting these people, putting the banks out of business. We put banks out of business every day in America, but not these guys. And what we have to understand is that Barack Obama played this issue the way he did because that's how he wanted to play it. Okay? We have to understand that. Now, this problem doesn't begin with Barack Obama. I'm just pushing the question back a little bit farther. You want to understand why he acted the way he did. You have to go back, I think, to the 1990s, to the presidency of Hillary's husband, Bill Clinton. And if you remember back then, this goes way back to the 1970s even. The Democrats were engaged in a civil war for years, on and on and on, fighting with one another over the party's identity, arguing over who they were and what they stood for. And there are all these different factions in the Democratic Party, and they fought like cats and dogs. But what they all agreed on one thing, and that was this, that the Democrats had to turn away from the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal with its fixation on working class people. Okay, they disagreed about everything else, but they all agreed on that. The Democrats could not be the party of Roosevelt and the New Deal any longer. And what Democrats had to embrace instead, all of these people said, was the emerging post-industrial economy. And the people that the Democratic Party needed to identify with were the winners in this new order, by which I mean the highly educated professionals who populate our innovative knowledge industries. And what I mean by professionals, you know, there's sort of traditional definition, lawyers, doctors, engineers, preachers, this kind of thing. But in the sort of new economy, post-industrial era, it's now an enormous category of people. It's expanded enormously. You have people like math PhDs who write derivative securities on Wall Street. You have biochemists who make prescription drugs. Now, if you go back to the 1950s, you look at voting records from the 1950s, sort of demographics of that era, professionals were one of the most Republican groups in America, right, when Eisenhower was president. You go up to the 1990s, the Clinton era, and they've completely changed sides. They're Democrats. They're some of the most solid Democrats there are. And I think that's the way to understand the Democratic Party. That's who they are, a party of the highly educated professional class. Now, as we all know, they have other constituencies, of course, minorities, women, and the young, for example. But professionals are the ones who always come first. It's their technocratic attitude that always tends to prevail. It's their, if you read something like the New York Times, it's always the tastes and manners of this class of people that are celebrated. And it's always their particular way of looking at the world that's taken for granted as being objectively, obviously true. So what I'm saying is that professionals dominate American liberalism and the Democratic Party in the same way that Ivy Leaguers dominated Barack Obama's cabinet, in the same way that billionaires dominate Trump's cabinet, right? So Democrats come up with all of these wonderful, flattering phrases for their favorite demographic, all of these terms of endearment. They call these high-achieving professionals the wired workers who will inherit the future. They're a, I'm sure you've heard this one before, they're a creative class that naturally rebels against fakeness and conformity. They're a learning class that truly gets the power of education. They're an innovation class that just can't stop coming up with awesome new things. And of course, Democratic leaders themselves are always drawn exclusively from the ranks of this particular social group, right? It's not a coincidence that Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton all have the same, very similar life trajectory where they are plucked from obscurity by some very fancy educational institution. Look at Bill Clinton, right? He's this kid from Hot Springs, Arkansas. He goes to Georgetown, a very prestigious school in America. He becomes a Rhodes Scholar, goes to Yale Law School, you know, where he meets Hillary, all of, you know, they always have these wonderful life stories that are defined by the time they spent at really prestigious universities. And if you look at their cabinet choices, both Clinton and Obama, it's all of these successful professionals, people at the very top of their fields, the very top of the orthodox definition of those fields, I should say, whose worth is established by the time they spent at graduate school or at some really prestigious college. So what do they believe? What do the Democrats believe? They think that professionals, this sort of magical class, are the heroes of history, right? It's this sort of debased pseudo-Marxism where this is the group that stands at the end of the terminus of the dialectic. These are the winners of history, this dialectic of, you know, creativity and innovation. They're also the number one constituency of the Democratic Party, and all the leaders of the Democratic Party are drawn from this same group. So this shift that I'm describing from your traditional working class, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, to professionals, this is what explains what is so frustrating about our modern-day Democrats, and it also explains why Trump beat them. Among other things, it explains very well the problem that I was describing a minute ago of Obama and the banks, this incredibly vexing historical question. Why did the Obama team refuse to do what obviously needed to be done with these banks? Why did they declare that Wall Street executives were going to be held to a different legal standard than ordinary criminals? And they did. The guy who said it had to resign, but he said it, right? Why did this administration choose Wall Street over average people again and again and again and again? Because for the achievement-conscious people who filled the Obama administration, investment bankers These people are more than friends. These people are classmates. And I mean that in both senses of the word. These people, they look at them and it's like looking in the mirror. You know, the Treasury Department looking at Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan or Citibank or something like that. The two groups are the same. People go back and forth through the revolving door. You know, there's no difference. They look at Wall Street. The Democrats look at Wall Street and they see an industry filled with people of subtle minds, this sophisticated jargon. Oh, God, they love that. And this extraordinary innovativeness. Do you remember the phrase financial innovation? That's what mortgage-backed securities were supposed to be, this wonderful thing. They were plucking wealth from thin air. Right? These are the sort of creative individuals the Democratic Party theory tells us we must honor and respect. Right? They're making these financial instruments that are so admirably complex. It's, you know, it's like financial rocket science, as one member of the administration said. And by the way, he said that when he was explaining why they couldn't prosecute these guys. Dude, no one understands it, man. It's like financial rocket science. So complex. Obama himself did an interview with Fortune magazine about 2 months ago where they're asking him, it was like the exit interview. They're asking him what he wanted to do after he left the White House. And you know what he said? Venture capital. This is the man we hired to get tough with Wall Street. And it's exactly the same when they look at big pharma, you know? So innovative, right? You can't import generic pharmaceuticals from India or something like that. No, no, no. You have to protect these innovative companies. You have to protect Pfizer. And folks, mega dittos for Silicon Valley, right? An industry that can do no wrong in Democratic eyes. I mean, so lovable, Mark Zuckerberg. So professional, so creative, that for this one industry, enforcement of our country's antitrust laws was basically suspended. For this one industry. So what does a party of the professional class believe in? The most important item, number one on the list, is, of course, meritocracy. The idea that the successful, the people who are on top, are up there because they deserve to be. They deserve their rewards because they are the best. And this is the first commandment of the professional managerial class. Everybody gets what they deserve, and what they deserve is defined by how they did in school. Right? They got that gold star from their teacher in third grade, and they went to Harvard, goddammit. And the only solution for you, if you care about inequality, if you're worried about your, you know, downward trajectory in America, the only solution is to go, like them, to a really top-notch college. This is a philosophy of winners, folks, and the Democratic Party is a party of winners. Now, let's think about this for a second. That is the left party in our system in the United States, a party that is openly of the economic winners. The Republicans are as well, but we'll get to that in a second. Different winners, right? So there's a reason that as Barack Obama was leaving office, he wrote a series of articles. The Washington Post called them his closing arguments, and he published them in academic journals, you know, Harvard Law Review, that sort of thing. There's a reason that Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, the whole idea was to reach out to highly educated Republicans in the suburbs. She did extremely well in wealthy college towns. Wiped out in the Rust Belt, as we know. Now, Donald Trump, for his part, will make, I think, a perfect epitaph for the era of professional class liberalism. This man is the opposite of what the Democrats respect. He lacks government experience completely. I mean, he's completely ignorant about the government. It's astonishing. He holds expertise in contempt. He is, you know, indifferent to facts. For bipartisanship. Do you remember how Obama was always reaching out for a grand bargain? And before him, Bill Clinton with his triangulation. They love consensus. Trump doesn't give a shit about consensus. This is not being broadcast, is it? Okay, yeah. This guy is a human middle finger for the, you know, for the respect for process and the stately contemplation that made up Barack Obama's vision of the presidency. And so we bounce on from government by one group of affluent people to government by a different group of affluent people. Consensus-minded centrism deregulates the banks and then yields to authoritarianism, which deregulates the banks some more, self-destructs, and lets the consensus-minded people back in. They get another chance, they inevitably fumble it, and so on. Where is this going to end? There's only one answer. It's when the people come back for their party. Thank you very much.
If you like that, then you have to read Thomas Frank's books. I'm reading at the moment Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, and I can tell you it's absolutely fascinating. But also Pity the Billionaire, in which he went and tracked what was happening to people post-global financial crisis, and here he found this resentment towards the billionaires that had done so well out of the crisis that they created at the expense of ordinary working people. There's a whole, he's written a lot of books and all of them are very interesting, but I think Listen Liberal is a book of our time. This talk was recorded live at an event at the US Study Centre at Sydney University. For more conversations with our columnists, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. We also have a weekly politics podcast that comes from our team in Canberra. Search for Australian Politics Live podcast to subscribe. And please don't forget to leave a rating or review. It helps other people find the podcast. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lines.